Okay, thank you, Leon, for the opportunity to be here and introduce this talk. Actually, my talk will have one big main subject, which is cuprates, and I've chosen to start with it because this is most of the effort of my group. But I will introduce, if I have time, two other topics. One is molecular magnets, and then frustrated magnets. In molecular magnets, I hope to present to you a very well-defined theoretical questions that need an answer. It's not a particularly difficult one, but I think people didn't realize the setting of this problem. But I will start with a magnetic analog of the isotope effect in cuprates. And this work has been carried out for many, many years, and actually went through three PhDs. So you'll see a collection of data which took about 10 years to collect. So let me start with something that you all know, which is the regular isotope effect in metallic superconductors. I just remind you, I'm plotting here TC versus inverse root of the atomic mass for three compounds where you could do the isotope experiment. This is mercury, tin, and thallium. And there are two things to see here. First of all, the regular isotope effect is a very, very small effect. The biggest effect in nature is for tin, it's 4% of TC. That's all you can do when you vary the isotope of tin. For the other ones, you actually need a magnifying glass to see that there are a few points here. But it's still considered a very important effect and a key for understanding of superconductivity, mainly because the line does go through the origin. So there is, you can take this point as another relevant point. And it's not just that the isotopes are varying TC. They vary TC in a way which really obeys this law that TC goes like nearly inverse the root of the mass. But now imagine that we did not...
This is very interesting speculation.
How do I know what?
How do you know that it really goes to zero?
No, I'm just saying that the
point certainly not. So what's the general?
No, you feed the land, you feed this. Let me explain to you what would be the opposite, and then you will understand what I mean. Imagine that I just had three points like this, 1, 2, 3, and I would fit a line that will go through here. That will be a bad situation. It means that the mass varies TC, but there's no proportionality. There's no rule like this. The fact that you could fit a line and then carry the line to zero tells you that it's not just a linear dependence, but it's a proportionality. Anyways, my talk is not about the isotope effect. This is taken as an important ingredient for BCS. And what I want to take from this graph is the following two points. First of all, the normal isotope effect is a very small effect. The biggest in nature is 4%. And the second is that if nature did not provide us with isotopes, and all we could do is compare materials like we do in high TC, we compare LASCO to IPCO to TAD, we would get the wrong answer. I mean, there is no connection between TC and to the inverse root of the mass. We would simply be led to the conclusion that phonons are not part of metallic superconductivity. So it's very dangerous to compare different materials. If you want to do an experiment and draw a conclusion, you have to change only one parameter, not more than one. And changing the isotope is one parameter. Okay. So now we go to the cuprates, and my group's main objective is to check if we could strengthen the magnetic interaction J with no other changes, like you do in the isotope effect, no other changes. Would TC grow? That means if we manage to make J bigger, for example, pull TNL up, will TC go also up? And the point is to do it with only one change. Change only J. Don't change the symmetry of the lattice at the same time. Now, of course, this would be a magnetic equivalent of the isotope effect. I don't know if you can see the bottom here. But the problem is that when you want to do such an experiment, it's very difficult because usually the only way to change J is by chemistry. And when you change the chemistry, you sometimes introduce different symmetries on the lattice as many other problems. But I hope to convince you this experiment is not inconceivable. And what makes it possible is a compound with a funny name. It's called Kalabalakio for short. And this is the formula of the material. And this material has two knobs on it. One is X, which is the amount of calcium, but not only. X comes here, 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 and here. And the other one is Y, which is the amount of oxygen. And X takes you from one dome to the next. So X equals 0.4 is the red, is the dome with the highest TC. And X equals 0.1 is black, is the dome with the lowest TC. So in a sense, X controls TC max, and Y controls where you are on the dome. And this material is written in such a way because it has a IPCO structure. So these two mount to 1, these two mount to 2, 3, and Y. So it's IPCO structure. It's tetragonal for all values of X and Y. So there is no symmetry changing as you dope or change X. There are two planes per unit cell always. You can overdope it, which, as we will see soon, it's very useful. Between here and here, there is 15% variation in TC max. And from here to here, another 15%. So altogether, you have 30% variation in TC max, which is an order of magnitude bigger than the biggest isotope, normal isotope effect in nature. Now, calcium and barium has the same valence. And you can see that when I change X, I can increase X, I will add some calcium, but I will take equal amounts of barium out. And lanthanum is fixed. So actually, calcium and barium cancel each other, and the valence is only determined by Y. So again, valence is set only by the oxygen, like in any other compound. Now, there's one thing I will not talk about in this presentation because it takes a long time. It's disorder. We were worried that what takes you from upper dome to lower dome is the level of disorder, so we performed NMR experiment. I'll just give you the highlight. The NMR lines here, 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 and here are the same. They're not delta function. There is disorder, but it's the same disorder. Okay, so the same level of disorder along the lines. And also, there is a little bit of difference in the ionic radius between calcium and barium. Again, I will, if you want, I will explain this at the end, but it was found not to be irrelevant. So at the end of the day, this compound, Kalabalakio, allows you to vary TC max with absolutely no structural changes that we can spot at this point. And the question is now, what would TNEL, TG, and T-star, for example, do? So the measurement we perform to determine TNEL and TG, and these are the ones that I will start with, are muon rotation experiment, which I will go very quickly over the technique. We shoot muons into the sample, and they stop somewhere and begin to rotate around the local magnetic field. In my case, the local magnetic field will be a spontaneous field. It's not an externally applied field. We cool, the material becomes magnetic, there is a local magnetic field, and the muon rotates. Now, the magic of the technique is that the muon decays to a positron, and the positron is emitted in the direction of the muon. So this will shoot positrons here, this here, and this guy will shoot them there. And we have positron counters, so you have a lot of count here, then a lot of count there, then a lot of count here. And so there's oscillation in the count, and that represents the strength of the magnetic field. So raw data will look like this. One counter will have, the backward counter will have oscillation and a decay. The decay comes from the fact that as time goes by, there are less and less muon in the sample. The forward counter will also have oscillation and decay, but out of phase from the backward counter. And then all we care about is the rotation. We don't care about the muon lifetime. So we produce a quantity called the asymmetry, which is forward minus backward divided by forward plus backward. That gives you just the muon polarization. If all the muons experience the same magnetic field, then this asymmetry will simply rotate. If there is, for example, a glassy state in your material, and each muon experiences a different magnetic field, you have to average over all frequencies, and all you get is a relaxation. So this is a case of random field configuration, and this is a case of uniform magnetic field. So now let's look at some raw data in this Kalabalaki material. The first sample that I'm showing here is a sample that we cool down like this. So it's an antiferromagnet. You start at high temperature, 381, and start cooling. In 381, the muon just relaxed. This weakly relaxation, this is kind of a background relaxation that we have. You cannot get weaker than that. And we cool. And all of a sudden, within 4 or 5 degrees after cooling, we start to get this muon precession. And so this will be called a Niel temperature. The Niel temperature by the eye, you would say, is something like 378. This is just between muon doing nothing than to muon oscillating with long range order. This sample is a sample here. We cool, it first becomes a superconductor, it has a TC of 33 Kelvin, but nothing happens to the muons. You know that it's a superconductor from resistivity. But if you keep on cooling, there is a temperature around 7.4 in which all of a sudden you see a spontaneous magnetic field. The muon is starting to do something, but never goes into long-range order. You never get an oscillation. So this is what we call the glass transition. There is a glass line starting here and going under the dome in which the spontaneous magnetic field in the form of perhaps island is generated. So this is what we call TG. And again, here you need to have a criteria to determine what TG is, but for this material, it's somewhere in between this function and this function, so maybe you would say it's 3.8. We have a more elaborate way of determining the critical temperatures. We fit it to two signals and do it more carefully, but that is not very important. What's important is the global phase diagram. So this is the phase diagram of this Kalabalaki material as a function of X and Y, and it's a very busy phase diagram, so let me go over it slowly. So it's color-coded. Red is X equals 0.4, so this is the TC dome. The TG is kind of the lowest from all the families. There is a sharp transition, there is a critical doping in which random spin freezing is change into a long-range order at a very special doping, and from here on it's TNL which goes up and saturates. The black as the lowest dome, its TG is always the highest. Again, a critical doping, TNL, and then goes and becomes a flat line. Now, there is something very similar between one phase diagram and the next. It looks that one parameter can take you from one to the other. And so the question is, how do we untangle this phase diagram? And the idea how to do it was as follows. There is one special doping where all materials have optimal doping, which is here. So instead of talking about amount of oxygen, let's talk about the amount from optimum. Okay, so I move the origin this way. Now I want to make a transformation that will make all my domes collapse into one. The way we do this is normalized by TC max. Okay, so we take every family and divide the all three critical temperatures by TC max of that family. That brings us all to one point. But still the legs of the domes are separated. So to make them come together, we separate the different data set and stretch the doping axis, multiply each doping axis by one number per family, and the number, this K, can be interpreted as doping efficiency. Not every oxygen puts a hole on the plane, so you need some efficiency parameter, K, and they are chosen in such a way that all the domes come together. Okay, so the only number I allowed myself to choose was this K, one number per family, to make the domes come together. Once the domes come together, a miracle happens. All the TGs come together, the critical doping of all families at the same point, and three out of the four families have the Niel temperature collapse onto each other. One family is sticking out. So So already this is very encouraging, because we've started with a phase diagram like this. We made a transformation from amount of oxygen to a parameter which we will call doping. We measure it from optimum, delta PM. And when we make this transformation and normalize the critical temperature by TC max, all the domes collapse onto each other. Here, you have 15% variation in TC max. So this is already a big variation. Why the black lines are out of here was troubling. One could say, okay, there is a non-linearity regime or something like this, but we wanted to understand why the blacks are not collapsing on the blue, red, and green. And so the idea was that maybe, in addition to doing the scaling, we have to worry about anisotropies. See, TNEL is not an Hamiltonian parameter. TNEL is set up by J and anisotropies. So we want somehow to extract the anisotropies. The standard way of writing the spin Hamiltonian is J times the in-plane coupling and two anisotropies, one in the Z direction in the plane and one between planes. And we would like to determine these two alphas. So how do you determine anisotropies? There is a way, a nice way to do it, if you don't have single crystals, it's to measure the normalized order parameter as a function of the normalized temperature, T over TNEL. The way you go from 0, 1 to 1, 0 to this point, the term is set by the anisotropy. A two-dimensional magnet will have a point here and an immediate drop. A three-dimensional magnet will have a flat line here and a drop only close to one. And everything in between, everything which is in between two and three dimensions, just has an anisotropy, will move from a line like this to a line like that. And so that's the way to determine the anisotropies. It turns out that TNEL is J times a known function of the effective anisotropies. Effective anisotropy is the weighted sum of these two anisotropies. And this function, the correction is known. It's a logarithmic function of the anisotropy. So that's the idea. Let's measure the order parameter as a function of temperature and try to fit to a graph like this and get the anisotropies. How do we measure order parameter? Well, I showed you the muon rotation frequency. The rotation frequency comes from the order parameter. It's proportional to it. So if you take rotation frequency normalized by the rotation frequency at zero temperature, you get the normalized order parameter. So here is my phase diagram. I'm now looking at these two samples, and what you can see is that when I measure the order parameter, the normalized order parameter as a function of the normalized temperature, the black is more stable to increasing temperature than the green. So that means the black is a little bit more three-dimensional than the green. Now, this is not the most accurate way of determining the anisotropies, but anisotropies go in the logarithm anyways. You don't need a very accurate way. You just need to determine the order of magnitude of this anisotropies. And that's how we did it. We determined the anisotropies, for example, for this sample, the red and the blue here. And then I can extract J by taking TNEL and dividing out this correction factor. And when we did this, we got what I would call the magnetic equivalent of the isotope effect. We have TC max here. We have four families with four different values of J. Now I'm not showing TNEL anymore. I'm showing J itself. And there's a straight line going through the origin. The first three points, which are 15% in TC max variation, need no theory. They come out straight. Or in other words, the anisotropies of these three is the same. This guy already has an increasing anisotropy, but when you take the anisotropy out of the problem, it falls on the line. So from this experiment, we learned that TC max is simply proportional to J. and you can compare it to the standard isotope effect. Now, we can do actually better than that. I analyzed only 4 samples here, but I can do the same experiment for all the samples. I can determine the J for all the samples by determining the order parameters for all the samples. And when we determine them, they introduce a lot of noise because the determination of alpha is not very great. But if we define a quantity which is called TNEL corrected, which is TNEL taking out the anisotropies, TNEL corrected in very, very low doping is simply J at this end. But when you come here, you are not dealing anymore just with the Heisenberg model. It's a perhaps TJ model, so it's not J. So TNEL corrected is not exactly J, but to that end it is J. And when we plot TNEL corrected TG TC divided by TC max as a function of what we think is the real doping, the phase diagram collapses all over the place. And that tells you that really, not only TC max, TC itself scales like J all over the place. So the conclusion from this part of the work is that there is a common energy J for the antiferromagnetism, the spin glass, because these are also come together, and superconductivity. Now, I started my talk by saying that nothing varies between the different families. So what does change the J? The J must be different between the different families. And this is something that you can not know if you only do X-ray on your crystals. You actually have to go and do a neutron ritual refinement, because neutrons are sensitive to the oxygen position and to the oxygen buckling angle. So there is a buckling angle theta between the copper, oxygen, copper. This is what yesterday was mentioned. I think you mentioned it as the overlap of the integrals. If the oxygen is sitting not in a straight line, the overlap of the p orbital of the oxygen with the d orbital of the copper will vary, and J will vary as a function of this angle. So we made a determination of the buckling angle, and this is the graph that we found. The buckling angle varies with doping, so probably J could vary. I'll show you that doesn't vary much. The buckling angle varies with doping, but most importantly, the red family, which has the highest TNEL, the highest J, and the highest TC max, has the straightest bond. The bond is the straightest of all. The black, which is the lowest, has an angle of 5.5 degrees, and this starts at 4 and changes a little bit. Another thing that we knew that is happening is that the distance between copper to copper varies just a tiny bit, and it's shortest for the red family. So the family with the highest J also has the shortest bond, shortest and straightest bond. Okay, shortest and straightest bond, and this has the longest and most buckled bond. So now to translate this to what a theoretician would like is, would require to go from distance and angle to Hopping rate and J. So Hopping rate, because the overlap integral of P and D goes like distance to power 3.5. But because the hole has to hop from copper to O and O to copper, you actually have to square that. So the Hopping integral turns out to be cosine theta divided by A to the 7th power, and J, which is T square, is cosine squared A to the 14th power. Very funny numbers, but we can now go from here to here. And indeed we find that the J for the red family, the family with the biggest J, is indeed bigger, and for the black it's smaller. So this crystal or crystal structure analysis is consistent with what we found with the MUSR. This is the biggest J, this is the smallest J. Now, there is an implication for this, which I would like to discuss, is the quantity T over J. You can take these two graphs these two graphs and obtain the T over J, and T over J for the red family is smallest and for the black family is biggest. Why? And the variation is 6%. Why am I showing this to you? Because I have an independent way of determining T over J. How do you determine T over J? If you look at the Stargardt magnetization, the Stargardt magnetization as a function of doping was calculated by several authors. The Stargardt magnetization as a function of doping, the point where you, the critical doping where you lose the Stargardt magnetization depends on T over J. Okay?
Assuming holes are mobile.
Assume?
That holes are mobile.
Yes. That
a small doping day would be self-localized.
I don't know. T over J, put in the computer, ask yourself where is the Stargardt magnetization, and that's it. When do you lose the, when the hole, when you have enough concentration, they'll move around.
So you want this flat space kind of symmetry, you don't want the curvature of J. Beautiful flat.
I want to discuss this critical doping where I'm losing my order parameter. One way to look at it is in this graph you've seen before. It's when TNL goes into TG. A different way of looking at the same graph, which is more nicely comparable with the theory, is go to zero temperature, sit at zero temperature, just change your doping and see where your M disappeared. Okay, so this is the graph. It happens at the same place, but this is when TNEL turns into TG is when your frequency disappeared. Okay, so here, what happens is that you have the muon rotates, and you lose the frequency. It happens at the same doping. But this is, rather than to tweak temperature, you put a sample, cool down, measure, take the sample out, put in a sample, cool down, measure, quicker. And this is more comparable to here. Okay, so it looks, if I plot it like this, it looks that the different families have different ratio of T over J. But I don't believe in Y. Y for amount of oxygen is not relevant. I like delta P. And delta, when you plot delta P, they all lose the order parameter at the same place. So if you believe my delta P, if you believe that that gives you the real doping, then the message is that the ratio of T over J is the same in all the families. So there's a contradiction here. From the order moment point of view, T over J is constant. From the buckling angle, T over J is varying. My conclusion from this experiment is that the effective Hamiltonian, which is responsible for the destruction of the order parameter, is not the TJ. It's something that have probably electron pairs, not a single electron moving on the lattice. Well, that's all I know that there is out there. There is either a single electron moving, and that's TJ, or there are whole pairs moving, and this will be bosons. And if I understand correctly, a model like this does predict a critical doping where the order parameter disappears to be independent of T and J.
I'm just confused about the role of this order. So
okay.
The description of the one angle variation,
yes,
is a local the one bond. But now if I look into the system, why should I understand that your J variation is homogeneous?
Yes, because...
So I'm still thinking about the random bond.
No. You
system.
No, there is for each X, there is a well-defined bond of the oxygen. The bond angle, and this is not random, because the calcium and barium are very similar, and lanthanum is not, the amount of lanthanum is not changing, and so the fluctuation when we do the rhythmic refinement, the oxygen come out to be in a well-defined angle, not in a broad angle. So the you have an error bar on the angle. So yes, there is a little bit of scatter in the angle, which is in the error bar. It's very different than the next family.
In principle, I like this very much, but the difficulty with this is, in, at least in my opinion, that with J you have all the electron photon complex hidden.
Very good.
And so the question is really about can you disentangle them?
Okay. So an experiment we do, a future experiment, is the isotope, normal isotope, dependence of TNEL. We are going to look at J as a function of oxygen substitution of 16 and 18. When this experiment is done, I will be able to answer your question. But at the moment, if phonons are part of the problem of high TC, they could be part of the problem of high TC via the J. But still, the J is the important part, and phonons can modify this. Now, is it important or not? I will be able to answer only in the future, but this is an experiment going on at the moment. Okay, so now can you change from principle liking it to really liking it?
Well, I mean, I'm a believer that it's a mechanically working superconductivity, and I think there are more and more experiments which go in this direction. But I mean, to be honest and fair, one has always to prove something which one doesn't want to prove, namely that the other contribution, in this case, electron-phonon interaction, is unimportant, but that's very delicate. I mean, there are, you know, the newest work is saying that these kinks, these features at lower energies at the photon emission, are likely not to be due to phonons. But if one is honest, the calculation is an LDA calculation, which is not an excitational calculation, which is a decoupling type of approach. So this is all very dangerous. So one looks for an experiment which can really hopefully disentangle the contribution from the
So that's the idea for our experiment. If we will be able to show that really the influence of phonons is through the J, then maybe the discussion will come to a convergence because there will be one route. But it's too early to say. Okay, so pseudogap. So I will go quickly on the pseudogap. We have a lot of sample, and we wanted to measure to see where the pseudogap is. The pseudogap also set by J, and we had to come up with an experimental technique when you can get a pseudogap temperature quickly, because there are so many samples. So it turns out that there is a very simple way of doing it. It was actually noticed in 1988. The name pseudogap did not exist at the time. But if you measure DC susceptibility, it looks at first just something like a Curie-Weiss term. But if you zoom on the high temperature part, there is a minimum of the susceptibility. And that minimum moves towards higher and higher temperatures as you take oxygen out. So it's very natural to assign this point with T star. Or a better way to do it is to fit your data to a Curie-Weiss term, which is the black one here, a pseudogap term, which is losing susceptibility as the Fermi surface loses its area. So there is less and less density of states at the Fermi surface, and a constant. And if you take a function like this with three terms, we can globally feed the data very well, but also capture the dip here very nicely. And so you get a T star. Now, as you know, T star, every technique has its own T star. But we are using one technique and four families. So at least we are consistent for this four families with one technique. And we managed to separate this star between the families. So the red family is here, and the black family is there. And now the question is, what does this star scale with? With TC max, or maybe with the maximum Niel temperature? So again, we don't want to plot it as a function of y, but what we believe is the real doping. And first we try to normalize T star by TC max. And we see the same problem that we had before. Three families come together more or less, and one is obviously sticking out. And that's what we had before. So the idea was maybe we resolve this problem by taking into account coupling between planes. So let's, rather than normalize by TC max, normalize by TNEL, the maximum TNEL of the family. And when we do that, all families come together. So T star does not scale with TC max of the family, but by TNEL max of the family. And TNEL of the family involves both coupling in the plane and out of the plane. And I'll go over this. Okay, so this brings me to the conclusion of the first part of the talk. And so this is the phase diagram and rescaled phase diagram, and each part of it gives us a new conclusion. The fact that when you extract TNEL corrected, when you extract coupling between planes, all critical temperatures scale with TC max tells you that TC is proportional to J and is actually a two-dimensional phenomena. You don't need a coupling between planes. The fact that the rise, the critical doping, is the same for all families tells you that the effective Hamiltonian is not TJ. That's what I can say. This takes us into contradiction. And now the fact that all TGs come together, see, TG is set by J and this order. If they come up together, that's an additional proof to the NMR that really the levels of disorder are the same and they are being factored out by this scaling. Finally, we look at the T star. T star, in order to get T star together, I have to normalize by TNEL. So all those graphs come together, but not here. And the fact that T star scales with TNEL tells us that it scales like J times the anisotropy, so it's a three-dimensional phenomenon. So that is the major work in my group these days. And before going, let me tell you what are the open questions. So this K, why did I need to stretch the doping axis? What is the meaning of this K is an open question for us. I told you that you can understand it as doping efficiency, but we already did one experiment that tells you that that's not a very good interpretation. From a nuclear quadrupole resonance measured charge, and we found no problem with the doping efficiency. The doping efficiency is the same for all the families. So K has a different meaning, which we don't know what it is at the moment. It's very convenient to think about it as doping efficiency, but each oxygen puts equal amount of holes on the plane for all the families from the NQR point of view.
Sorry, but you mean it's, we have evidence that the actual charged opening of planes is just depends only on y, or only
y minus y zero? No,
depends
on y minus y zero, but you don't need to multiply by any number. So a different way to think about it is that the doping in the plane is the same for all the families, but somehow some of the holes maybe are not so free to move. Okay, so this is why we call the parameter delta PM mobile. Yeah. So this is the new excuse.
Did you ever do experiments on the electron doped
solid? No.
And you would probably, one belief is that there's an anisotropy in where the electrons go versus the holes go, as well as everyone knows. And it looks in the one Van Hubbert type of thinking that this doesn't matter, so to speak. You cannot identify this famous drawing.
But I don't have a family like this.
I believe, and I really think these type of experiments could shed light on precise in this question.
Yeah, but the force of this experiment is the material. We have a material where I can vary TC max by 30%. Give me an electron doped material that you can do the same. I promise you I repeat all this project again. But that's the point, the material itself. Something that you can, with a knob, control TC max. I can do it continuously.
You say that maybe the samples are mobile and the samples are localized.
Yes.
Is it consistent with the NMR experiment you mentioned at the beginning?
No. So,
you say the gang is of the NMR.
So the NMR cannot, it's not the NMR, the NMR.
Independent of it.
Yeah, the NMR won't know if the hole is localized or moving around.
There's some difference in the local environment.
It's, the NMR is not sensitive. You'll have to explain to me what do you mean. In the NMR shift you mean, or in the NMR shift? So if you have a mixture and you have just a broad line, how do you tell?
Yeah, to the full front of which is the peak. If the samples are localized, then the surrounding environment is modified a little bit. Right? So I would expect that some peaks are shifted a little bit.
So all I can say is that the NMR usually in this, perhaps the oxygen NMR, but the copper NMR, which we did, is a very broad line, and you cannot see, you can come up with a model to fit the line, but it's not obvious that you have some a peak which belongs to localized environment and another peak which belongs to, what we know is that there is a spin glass. What we know for sure is that the spin glass is made of islands. You have islands of spins, and the rest is superconducting. So a picture where you have these two kinds of charges, some that are floating around and some that concentrate in an island, is not crazy, but...
Is it the truth that if some more holes are localized, the system is less homogeneous? Do they think so?
If there are
more holes are localized, the system should be less homogeneous.
Yes, I think so, yes.
I expect a broader basis in NMR.
Broad is a function of what? Broad there is a function of doping?
Broader peak for the case with more localized holes.
Partial K is a function of X.
The
constant
X.
Can't you balance your holes?
Balance?
Yeah.
I don't know what is balance, but I can show you the NMR data. You'll see where is the complication coming from. Okay, so this is the first part. If you have a question, I'm moving to a different subject.
Go back to your phase diagram.
This one.
So this last statement that was in PCR involves the interlayer coupling.
Yes.
How large is it? The magnitude of it?
How large is what in my T-star? T-star is the hundreds of Kelvin, so this is it. So if optimal doping is somewhere here, and zero doping is somewhere here, then it goes up to hundreds of Kelvin. T-star...
normally you think that... these materials are very anisotropic, and the free decoupling is sort of a weak effect. Right? And usually you think that such weak effects become more important as you go to lower temperatures. But you're telling us that
yes.
The region of the superconductivity, it's not affecting the superconductivity, but it is affecting
yes.
The which is a higher energy.
So what I'm saying is that T star is a poor man's TNL.
Yeah.
TNL is, you know for sure,
not
that...
Sure.
So this star...
The reason it affects TNL somehow is because there you're developing a long magnetic correlation length, which can amplify the effect.
Okay, so here you are developing not infinitely long correlation, finitely long correlations, and the coupling between planes helps you develop the correlation. What you're saying, I've heard from, I think, every theoretician that saw this day. but if you want to think about this star as Purz-Mantinyel, I don't think it's crazy to say that interlayer coupling helps you.
Probably has some knowledge of the magnetic correlation
lengths when you draw
scattering.
Yes, but it's not
pretty short.
It's pretty short. It's pretty short.
Seems a little unlikely to get this kind of amplification of small anisotropy.
I really wish that this had worked, but it doesn't. I really wish that when I normalize this stuff at TC Max, the black will come here, no one will argue with me, the paper will fly through PRL, and that will be all. But what can I do? I'm not doing this on purpose. Yes?
If you have any transfer data on this experiment,
Yes, so the TC from resistivity.
Well, but not temperature dependence, how do they scale from different X? Resistivity about TC, so for different X.
Where I didn't. Tell me what I'm going to learn from this, and I'll do it.
One part of it, some measure of mobility is in that measurement.
Yes.
Is there a big variation in mobility, mainly? I understand the resistivity is tricky, just to see how transport is affected
by
different X, by different. In different.
Families. I have resistivity data, but I didn't do anything special with it. No. It has underdog. It's doing what IPCO is doing. Yes.
We can determine this out same way.
The T star from resistivity, you usually have to go to much higher temperatures. Because the way usually people see resistivity is not a deep, but there is a linear behavior, then a change from it. So you have to, it's hard to know where is the linearity start. So you go to very high temperatures.
Is it about 30 Kelvin?
No, it can go up to 80. That's our
same as
IPCO. It's very some. Yes.
You can start seeing it at just a temperature. If IPCO.
You can start seeing
the linear part and after the deviation about 300 Kelvin something like that. The deviation from linearity to
In IPCO, this star should be at 100 Kelvin, optimally doped. So in this case, you get from 100 to 300, you get one line, and from it could be that. What we have at the moment is the T-star from susceptibility. We tried also to look with resistivity. It was just not easy to know. Maybe it's a material issue, but it was not easy for us to know where the linearity is changing.
I think the T-star is so different between it's almost like...
It's not necessarily different. It's different for nearly every two techniques that you do. You would get different numbers. But it's not different by order of magnitude. It's different by 50% or something, 30%. This is a problem we are aware of. So I started this part of the talk that. Okay, so So now a different subject that we are working on, and I've chosen to speak about this because at the end of this part there is a real open question for theoreticians. A well-defined one, I think. So it's an experimental estimate of the phasing time in molecular magnets. So what's the story of the molecular magnets for physicists? One famous molecular magnet is called iron 8, and it has 8 irons on a molecule, and this molecule is very, very far away from the next molecule with a lot of organic stuff, protons, calcium, carbon, whatever you want, and the next molecule is out there. And you have at low temperature, you have six iron spins pointing in one direction and 2 in the other direction, so the total spin of the molecule is 10. And that's a big moment. And the Hamiltonian of this molecule is minus dSz square. Minus. The most important part of the Hamiltonian is minus dSz square. And so minus 10 and 10 have the same energy. And if you put a magnetic field, you can lift one state up and bring one state down. So minus 9 and 10 could, minus 9 here and 10 could have the same energy, and so on. So as you sweep the magnetic field, if you put S dot H, you would have energy levels like this. This is a zero field. A state here will be in front of a state there. If you change the field, this state will be in front of that state. Okay, and you can have transitions. So what people do is they put a very strong magnetic field and do hysteresis loops. So here it is.
Can I ask what the red atoms are that are coupling the ions?
I think it's I'll give you the answer later. Okay. I don't remember which one is which. So what happens is this. You put a very strong negative magnetic field. That is like bringing this side very low and bringing this side very high. You cool down the systems. The system, all the spins go to the lowest energy, so they are centered here. Okay, so you have maximum negative magnetization. Then you start sweeping the magnetic field. Nothing happens, nothing happens, nothing happens. The moment you reach a zero field, you're in this situation. Plus 10 is the same energy as minus 10 because you are at zero field. Plus 10 is the same energy as minus 10. Then spins that were locked here can now flip to the other side and you get a magnetization jump. Okay? Then you keep sweeping the field. The next thing is this situation. Imagine that you swept quickly. Not all the spins moved from one side to the other. Some are left here. The next opportunity is when this is in front of that. So minus 10 is in front of 9. And when minus 10 is in front of 9, you get another magnetization jump. And so on and so forth. And so this the subject is called quantum tunneling of the magnetization. And you can see that the steps occur at equal intervals of the magnetic field. So this would be 2.2 kilogauss, 4.4 around here, 4.4, 6.6, and so on. And this, if you solve this problem, you really get that the jumps should occur at equal intervals of the field, and this is a very quantum. Good. Okay. What did I want? Okay, now you can also see that the jumps, this experiment, they sit at 40 millikelvin and change the rate of the sweep rate. So the slower you sweep, the more opportunity the spins have to transfer from one side to the next, and the magnetization jumps will be bigger. So the jumps are really sweep rate dependent.
The rate is really only matter when you are nearby the transition, right?
Yes.
You can sit there after you.
You can go quick or sit.
You
yes.
Can sit there for a while.
In principle, if it's absolute quantum. I chose to present to you the Iron 8 because this has another very nice effect that hysteresis loop itself is temperature dependent. So 1K is small hysteresis, and as you lower the temperature, the hysteresis loop grows. But below 0.4, this is 0.4, 0.3 on 0.04. Nothing is temperature dependent anymore. So this is a real, below 0.4 Kelvin, this is a real quantum effect. Okay? Okay, now comes how do you treat this problem? And how do you treat this problem? So when you sweep the field, this H is time-dependent part of the Hamiltonian. So you write sweep rate times T. Okay. Something has to carry you from this side to that side. So there has to be some SX in the problem. Otherwise, despite the fact that levels have the same energy, if there's no term that carries you from one side to the other side, nothing will happen. So this is not the final story of the Hamiltonian. There are more terms. The argument is, what are the other terms? And there are two ways to decide. The theoretician puts other terms and predict what this delta should be, what is the matrix element that takes you from one side to the next. And the experimentalist, just from the size of the jump, supposed to tell you what is this delta. What do the experimentalists do? They use something called the London-Zener theory. London-Zener theory is just this Hamiltonian. And delta is something you put by hand, and you ask yourself, if my state was if I had a state in the beginning, I propagated with time, what is the probability that my spin did not flip? And 1 minus will be the probability that my spin did flip. Okay, and Landau and Zener separately at the same year came with this answer. Okay, that's the prediction. And so what the experimentalist is doing, the experimentalist is sweeping the field, measuring the jump, height of the jump, the sweep rate the experimentalist knows. So it takes the delta out of the measurement, puts the delta on the table, and now the people that are interested in the materials try to predict this delta from the properties of the molecule. Okay. But this is a very simplified Hamiltonian, the Landau-Zener. There is no way that's the Hamiltonian. There is in real life, there are noises in the problem. And before I go to the noise, let me explain how one way to understand this result, not completely understand, but you solve this Hamiltonian with a time-independent Schrödinger equation. You kind of say to yourself, you know what, the sweep rate is slow, let's treat T as a parameter and solve the time-independent Schrödinger equation. That will give you time-dependent energies. This is one energy, and this is the upper energy. And one way to think about the problem is that in real life, when time is treated correctly, you go on one energy, and at some point, there will be a transition from the low energy state to the higher energy state, and then it will continue. To get this answer, you have to first sum all paths, sum them, take absolute value square. Okay, that gives you this answer. Now comes the stochastic Landau-Zener. In real life, there is noise. And so here is the noise term. The noise term is an internal field believed to come from nuclear moment. There are a lot of protons there. Protons produce a strong magnetic field, fluctuate. Leon, you will stop me when you want.
Can I ask a bit of a remedial question? Are these all IC3 plus? Because you haven't mentioned any orbital component.
No, I haven't. So iron 3 plus is with the spin with the spin 5 halves.
Oh, okay. So it's L is equal to 0. Okay. Sorry.
So there is noise. The noise you characterize by a correlator. The correlator has two numbers, the strength of the field and the correlation time of the field. So the stochastic Landau-Zener model has four parameters, alpha, delta, B, and correlation time. In order to do a theory, you have to be able to compare these parameters. So we convert all four to time scales. Tunneling time is H bar over delta. Zener time is delta over alpha. Correlation time is correlation time. And then there is a dephasing time, which is set by the strength of the noise. So that we have four times. And now, here is what I lay out for you. If you have four times like this, there are 12 options to put them in order. So there are 12 theories possible. 12 theories possible without saying anything about the symmetry of the coupling spin to field. So let's just take Ising or Eisenberg-like, there's twice, two options, so altogether 24 theories. There are 24 theories which the poor experimentalist has to sit there and decide which one to use to fit his data. And now, not all 24 were solved. And I'm going to give you a head start. I will now hopefully show you what is the correct order of time scales. And tell you for sure that this correct order of timescale was not solved. No one dealt with it. So you might be interested in this problem. So what I did, what our experiment was to estimate the dephasing time, so that at least we know how to order the timescales, and then we can approach the problem theoretically. Okay. So what was our strategy? Our strategy to estimate the dephasing time and to know, is it the longest, is it in the middle, is it the shortest? The strategy was to understand that the dephasing is a property of the environment and it should be molecule independent. So if I take the same environment, take my iron-8, pull it out, put something else which is more convenient to work with and measure the dephasing time, then it should be the same dephasing time, because dephasing time is set by the environment. Dephasing time is the noise, is the field from the noise and the correlation time of the noise. It's not the molecule. You have to believe that let's think about protons and molecule. My claim is that dephasing time is set by the protons. You have to accept that the molecule is not acting on the protons that act back. That's the only thing I'm asking you to accept. So that if I replace the molecule by a different molecule, I still see what comes from the protons. Yes. And in all molecules, the environment is protons, okay? So now what we'll do? We will work in zero field, so we will cancel this term. And we will replace the iron 8 by isotropic molecules. Isotropic molecules don't know what is SX. There's no SX. So this term also goes away. We are left only with the noise. So I will look at the molecules that the Hamiltonian is set only by the noise. So if this is the only thing that in your Hamiltonian, what is there to vary? In an experiment, we like to vary something. So we will vary S. We used molecule with S vary from 7 half to 27 half. And this is the first experiment in which the length of the spin is the variable of the experiment. Yeah, I don't think you've seen an experiment which you pull the spin out. Okay, so here are some examples of our molecules. And for example, chromium copper 6. It has a spin, the chromium spin 3 half, 6 coppers coupled ferromagnetically, so making 9 halves. Another example, chromium nickel 6, again, 3 halves in the center, coupled to 6 nickel ions, each one has spin 1, that makes 15 halves. Chromium manganese. And how do we know the spin value? We measure magnetization as a function of field, and we look at the saturation value, and we know what is the spin value of the molecule. Okay. The measurement we did is an, again, muon relaxation measurement. We measure the T1 of the muon. T1 of the muon is setting by the fluctuations of the molecule, and the fluctuations of the molecule is set by the environment. If there was no environment, the molecule would not fluctuate. So it's a little bit like this, but okay, so the muon T1 is set by the tau phi of the molecule, how fast the molecule is losing correlation. And this is the muon T1. So you shoot a muon and it loses polarization and you measure the rate. It, muon T1 goes up and has no temperature dependence at low temperatures, so it looks something that we don't need to worry about the temperature at low temperatures. And we measure it at all kinds of fields, but you can extrapolate to zero field like this and know what the answer at zero field would be. And this is the data for all eight molecules, for all eight molecules. So this is T1 as a function of field square. The theory tells us that T1 goes like field square. So if you plot T1 as a function of field square, you can get this tau phi out of it. T1 varies a lot between molecules, between the different molecules. So these three molecules are, had very short, very small T1s, so I plot them from 0 to 0.4. These two molecules had a big T1, so I plot them from 0 to 80 inverse microsecond. But in order to get tau phi, you have to manipulate this line. You fit T1 to h square and extract tau phi from the measurement. And here is the surprise. Now I'm giving you inverse tau phi as a function of S. The data is noisy because the molecules, after all, are not exactly the same, and the environment is not exactly the same. But what is amazing and surprising to us was that when you go from 4 to 14, more or less tau phi was constant at 10 nanoseconds. If, for example, 1 over T1 was a function of S, then a straight line should go like this, and straight line fits much worse than a constant. If it was proportional to S square, the fit is even worse. So constant is the best answer. Basically, tau phi is 10 nanoseconds, S independent. What can we learn from this? First of all, we can learn from this that if we compare our tau phi to tunneling time, which is 10 to the minus 4 seconds, the Zener time depends on sweep rate. In the lab, we can always make Zener time, which is smaller or equal to tunneling time. And tau C is 10 to the minus 6 seconds. So tau phi is the shortest time scale in the problem. The conclusion of the experiment is that tau phi is the shortest time scale in the problem. This is the case that was not examined theoretically. Why not? Because a theoretician, when he wakes up in the morning and he solves a quantum problem, he wants interference. If you have dephasing, which is very quick, you will not get interference. But that doesn't mean that you cannot get magnetization jumps. You can get magnetization jumps even without interference. And we don't know which formula to use to interpret the data without a model which has the tau phi as the shortest time scale. And now the fact that tau phi is spin independent is consistent with the nuclear origin of the stochastic field B. See, if the stochastic field B had come from a different molecule, when you make S bigger, you make this S also bigger, and then the field will be bigger, and tau phi will be shorter. But if the noise is not coming from the next molecule, but from protons, tau phi will be S independent. Okay? So that's the second part. Now I'm worried. This is not our work, but there are typical numbers, if it's nuclear moment, if it's nuclear fluctuation, and you can from NMR estimate the fluctuation rate of the nuclear moment. Leon, tell me if to continue or to stop. Okay. Third subject in the group, which is why I'm here actually, it's the properties of the Herbert Meta, the Kagome lattice. Oops, where's the picture? There's a picture. No, you can't see it. Okay, there's a picture of the Kagome lattice here.
What?
It's on my screen.
It's very subtle.
Okay. So the subject of the Kagome has still several open questions. Do spin one half spins on the Kagome lattice freeze? Is the ground state magnetic or made of singlets and not magnetic? What can we say something about the excited states? Not much is known. And is there a gap in the spin excitations? These are experimental questions. And finally, does the lattice distort to accommodate a spin pyral state? One way for a frustrated for a triangle to find a ground state, if you have frustrated spin on it, is to take one atom and move it away, and making the J weaker. So the distortion of the lattice can help reduce the energy. And the question is, would that happen on the Kagome lattice from an experimental point of view? So the group of Nucera came up from MIT, came up with this material. It's the first perfect Kagome lattice with spin one half. There is some debate in the literature whether it really has impurities or no impurities. The chemists tell us that as far as they can tell, there's absolutely no problem with the Kagome plane. It's only copper. Susceptibility, normal, this is susceptibility down to 1.2 Kelvin, found no magnetic order. And if you look at M over H as a function of temperature, all the graphs more or less collapse onto each other, especially in, at the lower temperature, telling you that really you can define a susceptibility here. And the only reason you believe that there is any coupling between the spin in this material is the fact that if you plot Tm over H, so susceptibility multiplied by the temperature, it's not a straight line. If you had isolated spin, T times chi as a function of T should be constant. But here it goes down. So that tells you that spins know about each other. That's the only evidence. Otherwise, you think it's a perfect paramagnet. No, each spin don't know anything about the other spin. Okay. So the experiment we did, and I'll explain to you in a second, we applied the magnetic field this time and look at the muon rotation in a field. And that allows you to measure two quantities. The data looks like this. The muon oscillates very nicely, and you can determine the frequency of the muon, and you can determine the global relaxation of the muon signal. So this kind of, it's called T2. And you fit your data with a function like this. You have a frequency and T2. Now, the frequency is not the frequency of the free muon because the sample has a magnetization. So there is a difference between the magnetic field the muon experience in the material and a free muon. And as you cool down, this frequency difference grows. We call this the shift in frequency. And that's a simple measure of the magnetization or the susceptibility. The advantage of measuring magnetization with a muon is that you also get another number, which is this relaxation rate, which you don't get in a magnetometer. So you have two numbers to play with. And the first thing we did is to take the region where we can measure shift on one hand and susceptibility on the other hand, and compare them and generate a calibration graph. Calibration graph that tells us, give me the shift, I'll tell you the susceptibility. Okay? And then we can, with the muons, we can go to millikelvin temperature, down to 60 millikelvin. And so here is temperature and shift. Using the calibration graph, we can go from shift to susceptibility. So now we can provide the susceptibility as a function of temperature, all the way down to 60 millikelvin. And we find no peak in the susceptibility. So as far as we can tell, there is no spin freezing or long range order or no singlet formation. Either one of them will cause you to lose susceptibility, but it doesn't happen. Now, what about T2? Before I tell you, show you the data, let me tell you what the interpretation of the data is. Imagine that you have a defect in your system. You have spin, 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 one is missing. Then this muon will see a different local field than this guy, will rotate in a different frequency than this guy, and that will cause relaxation. Different frequencies is losing of coherence and relaxation. Now you start cooling. There are two options. One is that as you cool, the moments just grow. And if the moment just grow, the field variation will scale with the moment size, or in other words, with the susceptibility. So if all that happens is that the moments grow as you cool, T2 will be proportional to the susceptibility. Sorry? The inverse. On the other hand, if there's something else, like lattice deformation, for example, these guys come together and these guys come together, now not only this is a different field than this guy, but also this is a different field than this guy. So in that case, inverse T2 will not be proportional to the susceptibility. So here I show, again, shift converted into susceptibility versus temperature. The shift is what you saw, the shift is here, the black. And on top of it, 1 over T2. And we see that they follow each other pretty closely. There's no big variation. In fact, you can plot once against the other, 1 over T2 versus susceptibility, kind of winds around a straight line. Here is an example where we know for a fact that there is a lattice deformation. So here, 1 over T2 is a function of chi. This is a logarithmic scale. So 1 over T2 grows exponentially as chi, nearly exponentially. But here it's also around a straight line. So that tells us that there are no lattice deformations. Finally, it was a mistake on our behalf to check how the field varies with field. How the shift varies with field. Basically, if the shift is susceptibility, it's not supposed to vary by field. Okay, but we went and checked it and even put it in a paper. And as a result, the paper is not published because we have to explain it. But again, I don't know how to explain it. Anyways, the shift vary with the field, and that's an open question, so I'm showing it to you. Why would the shift vary with the field? It's not supposed to. Why would a muon? Now, all I can say is that when things like that happen, it brings a lot of understanding at the end. So, for example, in the...
So, you mean that the susceptibility is not linear?
The DC susceptibility...
The modulation is not linear in...
What I mean...
Yeah, it might be linear, right?
No, I mean the following. When you measure DC susceptibility with a magnetometer, then you get the susceptibility is field independent. Okay?
Yeah.
But when you measure it with a muon, with a muon shift, then it turns out that the shift does depend on the field.
Is there any conventional magnetization measurement on that magnet?
Yes, the
MH curve, I mean.
This is what I show here, this line. I don't know if you can see, but M over H is age independent. All the lines follow. Once you take M normalized by age, it doesn't matter which age you chose. So I'm multiplying also by T, but here, but
does it float as a function of magnetic field?
No.
It's not so easy.
For all the fields, M over H is a number, field independent. So chi susceptibility is field independent. But from the muon point of view, it's different. So that's a mystery at the moment. Yes, that's right. That's right. Yes, that's right. So in the HTC, this kind of findings and problem led to a lot of understanding. For example, the copper T1 and the oxygen T1 are very, very different, and it's because of the antiferromagnetic correlations and so on.
Do you know exactly where the muon sits?
No, not yet. I mean, for that, you need a single crystal in this case. But usually, muon go to oxygen. They latch themselves on. You know, the oxygen is 2 minus.
Also a form factor issue here also.
Yes.
Which simply, I mean, the susceptibility is just some bulk that doesn't really.
Absolutely. Okay. The muon turns out, the moments are weak, the muon T1 turns out to be slow, so we went and we looked at the chlor T1 to look for the excitations. And so our experiments were done on powder with relatively low field, and this is what we found. Pretty flat behavior as you cool down towards kind of a maximum and then a decrease. And the decrease is slow. That is to say, if there was a gap in the excitation, you would expect a flat behavior at the bottom. You would expect 1 over T1 to go to zero over a certain temperature range. Or in other words, you would expect the decrease to be exponential, like this. But it's relatively slow, and the standard way of fitting T1s in NMR is by 2 magnon Raman scattering or 2 magnon any boson scattering. And it's a long story why, but you use a formula in which you have a magnon coming in, flipping the nuclear spin, and a magnon going out, and the formula has number of bosons plus 1, density of states square, and an integral. So what we did is to guess a power law for the density of states, and to guess a gap, so to do the integral from a gap to infinity, and to fit this to the data, and we came up with a gap which is minute. J is 200 Kelvin, this is 0.5. So basically what the system is trying to tell us is that there is no gap, and we came up with a power which is 0.23, which basically the system is trying to tell us that as the energy is going lower and lower, you're losing states. Now, our data was pretty noisy at first, and you could either fit it to this nice equation or just to a straight line. But just before we managed to say Jack Robinson, Imai came with a beautiful set of data, and pretty much looking like ours, but much more accurate. He used oriented powder, which enhances the signal and twice as high field. And if you fit the same equation to his data, this is not published because he didn't fit it to this equation. But we took his data and fit to the same equation, and again you get delta, which is basically zero, this alpha, this power law of the density of state, which is somewhat different than ours, but provides the same message that the density of state is decreasing with decreasing energy. And with his data, there's no doubt, a straight line does not go through the data. This formula is doing very well from 0 to 50 degrees. So to summarize the answer to the questions, do the spin freeze? So from this experiment, the spins seem to continue to fluctuate at least down to 16 millikelvin. Is the ground state magnetic? So yes, we found a saturation of chi, which means no phase transition and no singlet formation. What can be said about the density of state? So this rho of phi goes like e to the 1/2 is a fit to Imai's data, which is better. We found negligible or no gap. I think there is no gap. And since the T2 scales with chi, it means that there is no spin pyrus transition in this material. And that's really the end. Thank you.
Question going back to the two things. So you assume that basically the nail temperature is being set by J and interlayer coupling, which is the quantity which is somehow changing, or so, isotropy, yeah. Which is mostly interlayer.
Between families, the interlayer is changing. I went over this very, very quickly, so let me find. I actually can tell you how the interlayer coupling is changing, but I didn't discuss it, so give me 1 second. So this is the graph showing alpha effective for the different families. Okay, so yes. So the black, for some reason, is running very fast. Red and green have very similar effective anisotropies, and blue is somewhere in between. But when you take them into account, the effect of the black is the strongest. So
my question is there any reason to believe that the interlayer or the anisotropy is the main change between the different families that gives rise to the difference in...
No, the main change between families is J itself.
Is J itself, but in addition to J, the second most important one is it the interlayer, or maybe the interlayer is the same for all of them, and maybe there is something in the plane. You know, some kind of frustration parameter or ring exchange or something that is actually somehow critical in your changes in the nail temperature. I mean, that would imply that your earlier conclusion that the pseudo gap is being controlled by three dimensionality could be that the pseudo gap is being controlled by this extra parameter which is giving rise to the variation in the nail temperature.
You have to tell me exactly what parameter, because the best I can do is if you tell me what parameter, I go and I do an experiment. At the moment, with the parameters I measured, I can tell you the TC scales with J, and the T star scales with TNL.
Right, so there are two parameters somehow which are controlling the behavior of the insulator. And the question is, are those two critical parameters J and anisotropy? Or is it J and something else?
There's something else you have to propose, and I have to look for it.
There are some proposals which maybe hasn't been explored in this context, but they are there.
But you have to tell me what are they.
You mentioned one.
Huh? The what?
You mentioned one.
The ring exchange, for example.
Which has been used to fit spin wave.
I mean, do you have single crystals for these materials?
We are learning to grow
neutrons.
There are two future projects. One is the isotope, and one is that we purchased an image furnace, and it will take us a while. For some unknown reason, most of the experimental groups in the world are ignoring this material. I'm sure if, you know, one of the powerful groups in the world will decide, one of the single crystal growers in the world will decide that this is an interesting material, the progress will be much faster. We have to learn, because no one else is speaking this up, we have to go slowly, slowly.
Yeah. In the happy time, in principle, you may have just a
Maria. Yes.
Can you?
Yes.
we have a theoretical paper on that. But go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to know your comments about whether you can see something.
Well, Rajiv can fit the susceptibility data very nicely by adding a Dirichlet schema reactor.
No more questions, I'm sure. You'll be here the whole rest of the week.
Yeah.
Eager to discuss.
Eager to discuss.
Progressive theorists.